Good morning, everyone. I wanted to start by sharing an article that I read a few months back. This appeared in a newspaper in 1972. Perhaps some of you have seen this. This has been going around about 2 or 3 months back. And this is an article about Ananda from 1972. I don't know where it appeared. Maybe some of you have read this before. For those of you that are new, Ananda started as a spiritual community in 1969. Swami Kriyananda started a rural community where people could practice yoga and meditation and live a spiritual life in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada mountains. It's about 4 hours from here. And I'm just going to read a small excerpt from this article. "Not all of us parents of this generation agree with their definitions, but surely we are curious, and we do worry. Like the folks in Nevada City, deep in the green hills above Grass Valley, where it all began several years ago. Are they hippies? Asked a startled lady shopkeeper, watching the rattle-trap trucks with their long-haired occupants rolling through town. No, they're yogis, someone told her. Oh, that's good, she replied, immediately starting to worry about the yogis. What are the pressures of modern society that send this generation so lovingly weaned on Hot Wheels and Barbie dolls, groping after new lifestyles? Some admittedly are refugees from the drug scene trying to get their heads together again. Others, having been through the shiny glass doors of the business world, have retreated, disillusioned and frustrated." No, it's from 1972, it's almost 50 years ago. And a lot has changed since then. You know, the understanding of yoga and meditation as effective tools for how we work with ourselves. You know, this the recognition of Ananda as a community. We just celebrated 50 years of the founding of Ananda, which happened in 1969. And you know, all the communities we have around the world, which are testimony to the work we do. But there are things that have not changed. You know, when the human heart is inspired, when we recognize truth and we are drawn to it, and we are inspired to somehow align our lives to have more of it, to draw ourselves closer to it, we find ourselves out of step with the world around, especially those that might be near and dear to us. You know, I love the words, they're worried about the yogis now. And again, you know, I don't even think the reporter was trying to be objective. You know, lovingly weaned on Hot Wheels and Barbie dolls, groping after new lifestyles. It just doesn't make sense to the world around. It's not what they thought these young people were going to do. And in a sense, when we embark on this journey, when we start taking our spiritual life seriously, when we are trying to make these truths more real for us in our own daily lives, we suddenly discover these two opposing realities. This inner intuition that we ourselves have, this intuitive understanding of what truth is and how to make it real in our own lives, and the worry and the valid concerns of the people around us, in which, in a sense, it's not personal. It's not about your parents or your partners or your friends or any of them in particular. It is just the mass hypnosis of the world we live in, this belief that you cannot find happiness this way, that something else is out there for you. And we all go through our own journey in working with it. You know, it's not even specific to any particular culture, you know, although all of this takes different flavors depending upon where you're from, whether it's your friend wondering, you know, why do you always listen to that music that they play at your church? Don't you think it's a little dull and boring? Or, you know, maybe a well-meaning parent wondering, you know, I like that you meditate, you're doing yoga and all of this, it's really good for you, but why do you spend all your time in this ashram? Shouldn't you be focusing on your career, perhaps? You know, maybe, you know, work on that next promotion or whatever it is that, you know, it's going to take you ahead and, you know, make you a success in those terms. And we start to wonder ourselves. We start to question, we start to think about these things in light of the life where we come from, that upbringing, those Hot Wheels and Barbie dolls. You know, until I found Ananda myself, I always found a little bit like I was misplaced. I just didn't fit anywhere. It was not like I had trouble making friends or, you know, getting good grades or getting into the college I wanted or getting the right job or any of those things. But somehow it felt like there was some disconnect. Somehow it just did not gel together. And, you know, after I found Ananda, I still continued with my tech job here in the Silicon Valley. That's what brought me here. And that contrast became, you know, so much more pronounced. You know, before that, I at least used to try a little bit more, you know, have lunch with people, you know, try to relate to the conversations that people were having. I remember one of these conversations, this was after I came to Ananda many years back, and, you know, I was sitting in a lunch table with a few of my office colleagues, and there was this very engaging discussion about a lot of different topics, you know, the real estate in the Bay Area, and then one of them was considering buying, you know, they didn't like their condo in East Bay, so they wanted to buy a much larger house, which was even farther, and I thought he was already spending an hour and a half each way commuting, so I just couldn't make sense of why he would want a bigger house, just much, much farther. And then, you know, what was the game last night? You know, did you watch it? And, you know, I found this new vacation spot. I'm going to Caribbean again this summer. You know, my niece is graduating, so I'm planning to go to East Coast. Just, you know, it doesn't, the details are so irrelevant, but I do remember sitting there, you know, making an occasional remark, trying to be part of it, and then also just realizing it's not interesting for me. It's just, you know, my mind was so consumed. You know, I was thinking about how inspiring, you know, perhaps Gurudev was, you know, this book of Swami Kriyananda that I was reading. And somehow, I just felt like, why am I trying so hard? This doesn't even make all that much sense. So we all have our own ways of working through this. Some of us, you know, we try to be peacemakers. We try to somehow draw a line of balance. We try to find that elusive middle ground where you can have it all, you know. You know, Mom, I'm going to go to Ananda. I really need this, but I understand what you're saying. I'm going to go only on Sundays. You know, I'll work on my promotion. I'll do this. I'll do that. So we sort of try to bring it all together. We try really hard, very sincerely. And some of us, you know, who have a more passionate disposition, I include myself in this category, are so convinced of our own opinions that we take it upon ourselves and we believe, like the reading says, that truth is democratic. That somehow, if what I'm feeling and what I'm thinking is true, then it's only self-evident that I have to get all of these others to agree with me, that I just have to explain to them one more time. And, you know, it can take all kinds of different forms, whether it's, you know, gentle coaxing or intellectual hair splitting or arguments or, you know, you go through all these different cycles, you know, trying to sort it all out. And what this reading particularly is talking about in the West, it even sometimes takes extreme forms, this very sincere and well-meaning intention to share the light with others combined with this kind of brute passion that somehow this belief that truth is democratic takes people to extreme, you know, to make extreme decisions in their own lives. We've heard all these stories of missionaries going to Africa and India and all these remote places on the continent. And some of these stories are very inspiring, and some of them you just wonder, what do I make of it? There's these remote islands off the coast of India. They're called the Andaman and Nicobar Islands. They're not very well known, and I just happened to know them because I had a friend who came from there, and I always had a fascination, and I wanted to visit, which I've not done as yet in my life. And it's all beautiful. It's, you know, it's very idyllic, all these turquoise waters, white sandy beaches. It's like, you know, you can think of Hawaii or something like that. And I came across this news article many months back about one of these islands. I didn't even know much about this place. Only through this article I learned that only a very small percentage of these islands are actually inhabited by humans like us. There are still many islands which have native tribes who have no contact with the outside world. And this article was describing how these are some of the tribes, perhaps if there are many tribes like that in this, you know, on the planet, which have very limited contact with the outside world, but this one was the most extreme because they saw anything from the outside as an intrusion, and they would kill anyone There are many stories of how people went to these islands and got killed, and they're extremely violent tribe. They just, you know, like to stay that way. They don't need any contact with the outside world. And this article was about this Christian missionary. This guy from the US, his name was John Allen Chow. He was 26 years old. He was born to Asian immigrant parents who did not even speak English when they came to this country. And out of the blue, he decides, I'm going to go to the Nicobar Islands and bring the message of God, you know. And he goes there, and it's illegal to even approach these islands. There's like, you know, very strict perimeters defined on the waters. You cannot cross them because, you know, the military and the Navy and all of them understand how dangerous it can be. And a lot of people have died trying to do this. So he hires some fishermen illegally, and he goes to this island, and he makes some contact with these people. And what I found recently, which just surfaced, because I think I had read the article before many months back, this came up when I was doing something on the internet. It was a more recent article where people have discovered, or rather decided to share, some of his personal diaries, the things that he was writing while he was in the Andaman and Nicobar Islands, because he had made a few contacts with these people, and he had some interactions, and he kept coming back. He kept going to this island illegally with the help of these fishermen, and he would come back, and he would write these diaries. And finally, he decided that these people will never take him seriously. They will always see him as an outsider if they saw the boat waiting for him. So he decided that he needs to just go to this island and be there and send the fishermen away, which is what he did, and he never came back. And the fishermen did see him right away being shot by an arrow and then dying right on the spot, so it was graphic. But there are these diary entries of this man writing about his experiences. You know, he's just meeting these tiny little Aboriginal kids, giving them supplies, giving them snacks or whatever. You know, all these people are so curious. They come close to him. They're holding their bows and arrows and spears and all of that to attack him. And he's telling them, I love you. Jesus loves you. I have come here to bring the message of God. So anyway, the story ends there. And it's sort of a mixed bag when you read something like that. You are so inspired, you know, just the faith and the devotion and the courage and, you know, the sheer unshakable fortitude and, you know, his faith that he had on Jesus and the Bible, that he could just go there casually like that without regard for his own life. And then just the sheer lack of common sense. You know, I don't know what else to call it. You know, what was he accomplishing by doing that? You know, was that really what Jesus Christ wanted him to do? I don't know. I mean, if you're self-realized, you will perhaps know, but you do wonder, because he didn't accomplish anything in any recognizable sense, and he lost his own life, which might have been spent in doing great work for Jesus Christ. And you sort of wonder, how do you work with it? And that's exactly what we are hearing in this reading too. And I realize there's a fundamental difference between that kind of institutional religion and what we call the path of self-realization. In institutional religion, you subscribe to a system of belief. You follow a certain set of rules, and then you do your best, and you just try to be as nice a person as you can be. You don't try to be mean to others. You know, you don't torture puppy dogs, or you just don't do very awful things, and you're set. And then you go to heaven and you live happily ever after. That's the end of the story. And then if you want extra credit, if you're really that sincere and devoted, then you can go to all these other things. You can go to all these remote corners of the world, taking the message of Christ, trying to bring this to others, just out of the sheer compassion and goodwill of your own heart. But you see, the path of self-realization is quite different. Because here, you come to this understanding based on your own experience that there is a higher truth, that somehow, by aligning myself, my consciousness to this truth, I can find a center inside myself, and I can find greater happiness. I can find what I'm looking for outside, inside myself. And you also make a commitment, not to an outward system of belief, but to your own inner spiritual life. And the main difference is you're not all set, because that's when it begins. That's when the project even starts. Because from that point on,
you've received the awareness, you've received the tools that you needed to work on yourself, to work on your own consciousness. And then it becomes a moment-by-moment work of self-transformation, of letting go of that limited identity, of attuning yourself to that divine will, or doing our best, that sincere effort that we put one foot in front of the other. So, and in that sense, we start to understand that the only project we are working on, no matter what our outward work is just one thing. That is the transformation of our own consciousness. It's not necessarily feeding all the hungry people in the world or converting all the heathens to the light or anything like that. Although it can be worthwhile, it can be one's own particular dharma to serve the world. Because again, in the reading from the Gita, Krishna talks about it, do not share this with anyone without devotion or self-control, and who's not serviceful, who's not rendering service. So we do serve the world, we do our best, we do share the light, but it's not our responsibility. The only responsibility we have is for the state of our own consciousness. And when we hold on to that, then we start to make progress on a level that we otherwise cannot work on if the goals that we define are only outward. And then the spiritual path starts to make a whole lot of sense to us in a different way. Then the common sense part also comes together. When I was thinking about this reading, I was telling my friend Navashan that just a couple of days back, this reading is very tricky because the pearls and the swine and all that, because no matter what story or example I think of, somebody has to be the swine. So I have to be very careful in even the examples I give. And then, thank God, I remembered another expression that we often use in India. It's very commonly used in my mother tongue, especially, communicating a similar thought. We always say, like, the flower garland in the hands of a monkey. And, I have not spent time with swines. I don't even know what they would do if they were offered pearls, But if you have not seen a monkey with a flower garland, which I happen to have seen, I can assure you, you will never be able to forget that sight. Because it takes the monkey about 10 or 15 seconds to take each petal apart. And then even the thread that's tying the garland, somehow it's shredded into pieces. You don't know how the monkey does that. It just happens like in fast motion in front of your eyes. And before you realize, there's nothing there. But in a sense, that image was very useful for me, because the swine that we are talking about is not the people in our own lives. It's not your friend who doesn't know about Kriya Yoga. It's not all your office colleagues who are constantly discussing about real estate or the next promotion or the next hike. The swine is that loyalty to material consciousness. The swine is that intellectual pride. The swine is our own doubting mind, that monkey that's trying to take things apart, that keeps us away from understanding and realizing that truth. And the same example, this whole principle that we see played out in these dramatic stories is also what's happening inside of us. Because what's holding us back, if you were to think about it, Divine Mother cannot give us those pearls either. Because if we had that swine consciousness inside of us, and all this we see reflected outside is simply what's inside of us, that loyalty to materialism, that belief that somehow, although I want to be spiritual, I want to do all this, I want to have, a daily meditation practice, I want to be a nice guy, I want to be able to choose happiness, I want to dedicate myself to something bigger than myself, but also, I would like to have a slightly bigger house, maybe a new car will make me happier, a very dear friend of mine from Ananda, I met him at the village, and he was driving a new Tesla. This is the really large one, and he was explaining to me how, once you're inside, you can move everything. You can move the seats, you can make it all look like a whole apartment. And for a moment, I was just so fascinated, and I was like, and I asked him, how much does this cost? And then he told me how much it cost. Thank God I came back to my senses at that point. But there was a brief moment in there, maybe that's what I need. wow, this is what I've been missing in my life, a huge car where I can literally move the seats all around and to create an apartment whenever I'm traveling. You know, but that's the last thing we need. Because as long as we hold on to that so strongly, that's really what the reading is trying to tell us. Those pearls will not be accessible to us. We need to transmute that inside of ourselves. And then we realize, yes, there is somebody I need to convert. And I am looking at him every day. And I do need to bring the message of God, not to all these people around, but to this person I'm looking at in my mirror every morning when I wake up. And it's a project that I have to work on every moment of every day. It's a project of transforming my own consciousness. And that's the only way I can actually fulfill my purpose. You know, there's a beautiful story that I'm sure some of you have heard from the life of Swami Kriyananda. When he was traveling the Holy Land in Israel, there was this very fundamentalist Christian man who approached him with this kind of, you know, his own rigid opinions of the Christian truth, and just, you know, almost coming up to Swami, straight up to his face, yes, do you believe that Jesus Christ died for your sins, or something like that? And everybody who was with Swami was shocked. You know, how do you respond to something like that? This man almost looks visibly violent. And Swami, without skipping a breath, immediately said, you know, how can God die? And I think about that, of course, on one level, it sounds like, wow, what a witty comeback. I wish I had that presence of mind. You know, but in essence, it was more than a witty comeback. Because there's so many ways you can deal with that consciousness. There are so many ways you could respond to that. You know, most of our initial instinct is to sit and explain, you know, the true teachings of Christ. What did Yogananda tell us? You know, what is truth? How democratic is truth? But then, how is that going to help? How is that going to serve? In case of Swami, it was not an intellectual process with which he figured out, oh, if I said this, then this man would, you know, somehow understand, or I can get away from the situation, or I can end this conversation. It was simply that he was in touch with that truth. So he knew in that moment what would be the right thing to say, just to crack that shell a tiny little bit, not to hurt, but just so you could bring that light a little bit into the darkness of that swine consciousness, that density that we all hold inside ourselves. And in our own lives, that's how we work with ourselves. That's how we work with things around us, because we realize sometimes our own instinct, you know, to share the truth or share the light is sincere, is well-meaning, but also comes from this genuine and dogmatic belief that truth is democratic, that if I am right, then everybody has to agree with me. Then I just need to explain it to all of them. And truth isn't. I mean, look at the world outside. Do you want truth to be democratic? You know, it's just like all these elections and politics and all of this. If we don't need a better example to realize, I'm not, again, democracy is really the only possible form of governance or, you know, a civilized form of leading ourselves at this stage in the cycle of this planet. But also, mass consciousness is really not worth giving so much respect to. You just see the world outside, and what it's reflecting back to us is not really where we want to be if we want to be happy. It's not going to give us the solutions that we are looking for. This whole world, I remember so clearly, you know, just sort of trying to make sense of all of this in my own head, you know, just being part of the Silicon Valley environment, where people are constantly driven to the next step, to the next promotion, to the next job. You know, I had a friend whose life aspiration was to work at Google. And, you know, he was convinced that that was the best thing that he could have in his own life. And he did his best. This was, I mean, I'm not talking after he came to the Silicon Valley. I knew him since high school, college days. Since then, he wanted that. And then it took him a long time, perhaps 12 or 15 years, until, you know, he went to grad school, and then he had a few other jobs. Finally, he was working there. And then recently, I heard through somebody else that he quit that job. Because now he wanted to work for a startup that did this and that, and I'm not going to go into all those details. But we are constantly looking for the next thing. We're constantly out there because there is this hypnosis. There is that monkey consciousness, which is trying to tear things apart, which is somehow trying to tell us, oh, not this flower garland, maybe this next flower garland has what I'm looking for. What's inside these flowers? What's inside this thread? Trying to tear things apart. But it's not going to take us to any of the solutions that we're truly trying to find, because we then realize all that we're looking for here, in, you know, outside of us, all this disconnect that we feel is in fact how things are meant to be. This disconnect cannot be resolved. There is no peace here, because this disconnect is simply because of the fact that my vibration is getting more refined. I don't wish to any longer subscribe to this hypnosis. I don't wish to be part of this. I don't wish to be thinking about the next large house in East Bay. I don't wish to be thinking about the next car, the next promotion, the next relationship. It's not that I can get away from all of that right in one moment, or I can sort of go face-to-face battle with it and explain to everybody else in the whole world why they're, you know, that's not what they should be seeking. But in my own heart, find that place. You know, what is that in me that is still holding me back? What is that swine inside me because of which Divine Mother still cannot put those pearls in front of me? You know, a few years back, I was at Ananda Village, and I remember this image very clearly. It was a winter morning, and I was staying with some of my friends, and I was going for the group meditation. And I was walking, you know, it was a very cold day. I had my head covered. I was wrapped in a shawl. I was clutching my meditation pillow and taking my Om board and all of this and just sort of marching towards the temple, you know, with all the determination. And I see a couple of others doing the same thing. I meet them on the way, and I walk very fast, so I pass a lot of people on my way to the temple. And then I meet three others. And then I meet more people, and then I go to the temple. There's a lot of people sitting there. And then I remember at that moment, it's just a very normal day-to-day scene in a spiritual community like ours. But it made me think, you know, the great blessing, the great fortune that we have an opportunity to disconnect from this mass consciousness. I can wake up in the morning, I can take that meditation pillow, and I can take my Om board and walk up to a group meditation. I can go to that altar, and then I can disconnect. I don't have to live in that swine consciousness. In the Gita reading, Krishna explains it so beautifully. Self-control and devotion, the attitude of service, and I can develop those. And eventually one day, that swine will disappear because that hypnosis really cannot stand that divine consciousness. Once we are actually ready to receive the pearls and once we are truly receptive, then those swines and those monkeys automatically disappear. We don't get rid of them by fighting them head on. All that we have to do is lift our consciousness to look up. And then gradually, we make more progress in the only project we are working on. And we look at the mirror, we wake up in the morning, and we realize, wow, I have accomplished a lot. You know, I have made progress in this project in my own life. I still have not reached the end goal. There's still a long way to go, but I can be proud of myself. And I also know what I need to do. And from that point on, the journey becomes very different. We become closer and closer. We come closer to the understanding of that truth. And the day when we can actually receive all those pearls is not very far. God bless you all.
Through many lives, I've drunk the cup of laughter. No man could tell the pleasures I have known. The stars in the endless sky, if one could count, would come to billions. Yet as vast as are that number, so many years I've wandered far from you. Yet as vast as are their numbers, so many years I've wandered far from you. many lives I've drunk the cup of sorrow. No man could tell the bitter tears I've shed. The drops in the endless sea, if one could count, would come to billions. Yet as vast as are their numbers, so many years I've wandered far from thee. Yet as vast as are their numbers, so many years I've wandered far from you. Through countless lives I've sought your cup of sweetness, found other cups, yet thirsted evermore. The streams in the hills of time all found their way into a desert. Every noon of bright fulfillment, ere many hours did sink to evening gloom. Every noon of bright fulfillment, ere many hours did sink to evening gloom. I long for you in summer and in winter, only for you my heart thirsts day and night. I've learned that the sweetest songs ears ever were but your echo. Lord, at last fill me completely, for nevermore I'd wander far from you. Lord, at last fill me completely, for nevermore I'd wander far.